Welcome back to Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR, and welcome to all of our online listeners at WKAR.org. We're always there as well. Coming up today, fascinating segment we have planned. Learn about the challenges faced by intersex individuals and their families. These are babies whose sex is not clear, not clearly female, not clearly male. We'll learn about how the medical community and families respond to that condition and all the various considerations that are going into that here in 2014. We're hoping you can stay close. It's back to school week for thousands of students at Michigan State University. In between moving into their dorm rooms and finding their way around campus, freshmen have been reading this year's One Book, One Community selection. Congressman John Lewis of Georgia has written a graphic novel called March Book One. And Mr. Lewis was in East Lansing yesterday to speak to incoming students and to meet members of the community. Current State's Kevin Lavery had a few minutes with the civil rights icon. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. Yes, John Lewis truly is a legendary figure in the history of the civil rights movement. He is the last surviving member of the Big Six, which was a key group of activists which included Martin Luther King Jr. He directed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he led the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama in 1965, which was referred to as Bloody Sunday. He was severely beaten at that time. Mr. Lewis has shared his personal story many times, but I asked him why he chose to depict those events in a graphic novel.
My staffer, young man by the name of Andrew Iden, came to me in 08 and said that I should write a comic book, and I said, no. And he kept coming back over and over again, and I finally said, yes, if you do it with me. Much earlier, in 1958, I read a little comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. Told the story of the struggle in Montgomery when Rosa Parks took her seat and refused to get up. And that book inspired me. That book influenced me and a whole generation of young people. And I was convinced that we should do it. And because of that conversation with Andrew Iden, we have the book, and it's been very successful. March, book one, will be followed by book two and book three. It is my hope that it would inspire another generation of young people to find a way to get in the way and get in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble.
You will be the leaders of the 21st century. You must find a way to get in the way. You must find a way to get in good trouble. And make our society, make our country a better country, make our world a better world community.
I think that was the summation of your entire speech.
Well, I've been saying it for a while, and I believe there come a time when you see something that is wrong, that is not right and not just, you have to get up and do something about it. Speak up, speak out. And you may get arrested and go to jail, you may be beaten, but you happen to change things.
Do you feel that the very definition of civil rights changes with the times? Today we have the LGBT community, we have immigrants. Do they have different expectations about what they believe their civil rights are?
Well, the struggle is one of the same. You cannot have civil rights for one group and not civil rights for all people. I think the immigration fight, the fight for the gay community is built on the civil rights movement. You must have equality for everyone. No one can be left out or left behind. My position is very simple, that you cannot discriminate against people because of sexual orientation, and you cannot discriminate against people because they may be living here and some people have said they're illegal. In my book, there's no such thing as an illegal human being. We all come from some other place except Native American. So we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we'll perish as fools, as Dr. King suggested.
In your experience, what does it really take
to teach people not to indoctrinate their children with a, I don't want to say gospel of hate, that's not the right word, but an indoctrination of hate? What does it take to win hearts and minds?
Well, I think it's important to say to young children when they're very, very young, by living a life of inclusion, children learn. They learn, they observe very, very well. And some little children, you see them, you meet them, it seems like they've been here before. They follow examples. I hear children say, I grew up in a home where we didn't put people down because of their race, or their color, or their nationality. And that's a good thing. We have to say to young children, and to all children, that hate is too heavy a burden to bear, that love is a better way, to be kind, to live in a world of peace, in a world of freedom and inclusion is the best possible world.
Today's generation has an activist spirit, but I think it's a lot less visible because much of it now is through social media. Even though it may not be out visible in the open, is it still as vibrant in your estimation?
Social media is powerful. It brings people together, but I also think there still is a need for people to be visible, to be able to march, to be seen together. And that's what was so powerful about the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. King would say, there's not anything more powerful than the marching feet of a determined people. To see people walking in a silent march, not saying a word, across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma almost 50 years ago.
It would be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue.
But to see hundreds and thousands of people marching on Washington.
We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom and we want it now.
To see young students sitting in at lunch counters, or to see blacks and whites and others getting on a bus to ride through the South, to say that we will not tolerate segregation and racial discrimination. That's powerful.
Do you feel that there is a sense of sacrifice today, or is there a strong sense of entitlement that doesn't feel like it did in the 60s?
Now, I think many young people today are learning from the 50s and the 60s. That's why March of Book One, I think, is so important for people to understand what we did and what we were able to accomplish. So when people said nothing has changed, and just said, come and walk in my shoes, the world is different. It's a better world. The signs that I saw when I was growing up saying white, color, they're gone. They will not return. The only places our young people, our children going to see those signs will be in a book, in a museum, or on a video.
March 7th of next year is the 50th anniversary of the march in Selma. What are your plans to commemorate that?
Well, we are in the process of planning. We plan to go back to Selma, back to Montgomery. We are inviting President Barack Obama, President Clinton, President Carter, President Bush, too, members of the Kennedy family, members of the Johnson family, and hundreds and thousands of Americans to return to Selma and to Montgomery. Because 50 years later, it's an unbelievable country we live in. We're not there yet, but we're still on our way. It's better, much better.
Congressman John Lewis represents Georgia's 5th Congressional District. He is a civil rights leader and icon and the author of March Book One as part of the One Book, One Community series here in East Lansing. Thank you, Congressman Lewis.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery. Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on the Toledo water crisis, which was in the news for several weeks this month and could be again. Gary Wilson, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, Mark. Always good to be with you.
For many of our listeners who may have been on vacation and missed this story earlier this month, summarize for us what happened in Lake Erie to affect the water in Toledo and some Michigan communities.
Sure, Mark. It's the algae blooms. Algae blooms have been prevalent in Lake Erie and in other places around the Great Lakes, but Lake Erie is the prime area. Algae blooms got pushed by winds into the intake pipe that brings water to Toledo and also into southeastern Michigan. Testing revealed higher than permitted levels of microcystis, and they had to shut the system down. No drinking water. And you can't even boil it because boiling it just exacerbates the problem. So total of about 500,000 people, mostly in the greater Toledo area, and I think about 30,000 in southeastern Michigan, were without water for 3 days. So you can imagine the havoc that caused. People were driving 100 miles or so just to get bottled water, and of course, people aren't happy. So that was a big story, big national story, international coverage, and really should be a wake-up call for this region.
How did the algae bloom develop?
There are a number of causes for the algae problems, Mark. The agricultural runoff, phosphorus, primarily coming off the farmland into the Maumee and into Lake Erie. This has been developing for a number of years. And it just keeps getting worse, and unfortunately, we haven't been able to do much about it or had the will to do much about it. So, and it's not going to go away quickly.
Great Lakes journalist Gary Wilson is our guest on our monthly Great Lakes Month in Review segment. Gary, this may seem like kind of a stupid question, but some of us remember years ago, back in the 1970s, the moves to ban phosphates in consumer products like laundry detergent. Wasn't that supposed to keep this kind of thing, the algae blooms, from happening?
No, the phosphates in the laundry products, that was the first cause of algae, and they finally had to regulate the products that it kept those phosphates out of the Great Lakes. But this is primarily from fertilizer. The phosphorus in fertilizer runs off into the waterways. There are contributing factors, the outflow of sewage from the Detroit River that works its way down into western Lake Erie is a contributor, but I think there's general consensus that it's primarily the agricultural runoff, and what we're going to do about it remains to be seen. The community is split. Do you continue to rely on farmers to use what they call best practices, or do you regulate it? Just do what we did with phosphates, regulate the commodity and see if that will fix it. There's a big divide there on that issue.
So we're now at sort of the post-mortem stage. Talk about the responses to the algae problem from environmental organizations and governments and agricultural interests.
Sure, Mark, and this is where I think it gets really important. I've closely monitored the responses, and I was disappointed. This was a major event, 500,000 people without water for 3 days, and this was a failure for the Great Lakes region. This region has been fighting for a number of years and with some success to sort of reposition itself as a land with water. We're talking about the blue economy. And then all of a sudden this happens where you've got 500,000 people without water because we haven't taken very good care of it. The responses, like I said, were disappointing. Farm bureaus in Ohio and Michigan were very quick to come out with statements about all the things that they're doing. Government officials were quick to talk about some things that they had done in the past, some legislation that had passed. And rather than people pausing and not immediately getting defensive and relying on talking points, I was hoping for some reflection, and it just didn't happen. And I've got a couple of examples in Michigan where You know, that's what we saw. One's with an environmental group, the Nature Conservancy, and the other was, I spoke yesterday with the Michigan Department of Agriculture's Jamie Culver Adams, and she's the director there, and her points were pretty much on what I was saying, on target, that here's what Michigan's doing, and we're, you know, we don't need to be regulated, and I just don't know that that's a good starting point for this problem. In the Nature Conservancy, I talked with Dennis McGrath at the Nature Conservancy. He's the director of their Great Lakes Project, and he wanted to set aside the debate about whether we regulate or whether we rely on voluntary measures. And I just don't know how you can do that. That is the issue.
And aren't some experts saying this may not even be the last time it happens this summer?
We're not even to the peak algae bloom season yet, Mark. Usually it's in late August, which is just about now, and into September. We may not even be out of the woods for this year, let alone for some number of years.
So what do you think happens next?
I don't know. People are, you know, there are a lot of meetings. Legislators in Ohio held hearings. Legislators like to have hearings. There's an environmental coalition of Great Lakes groups. They've really asked for some strong measures. But I can assure you that there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of public discussion, but there's a lot of discussion behind closed doors where people are, hopefully they're having honest discussions. But when you have a city the size of Toledo without water for 3 days, the memory of that's not going to go away quickly. So I think we're at crunch time. People are going to have to start taking this issue seriously. Because I don't think citizens in the region will stand for much more of this without, you know, being without water.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thanks for your time.
Always good to be with you, Mark.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Is it a boy or a girl? Is usually one of the first questions out of a new parent's mouth. But what happens when the answer is, we're not quite sure? A whole range of medical conditions fall under the term intersex, a diagnosis where a child's sex is genetically or sometimes physically ambiguous. In some cases of intersex conditions, also known as disorders of sexual development, or DSD, doctors and parents choose to perform operations that intend to assign the child a sex. But how does being diagnosed with this very sensitive type of condition, or undergoing surgery, affect intersex individuals and their families? To learn more about this incredibly complex topic, I spoke with Lansing-based intersex advocate Alice Drager. She's also a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Joining us over the phone was Dr. Arlene Barretts, a Pittsburgh radiologist who is a parent leader and board member of the AIS-DSD Support Group for Intersex Women and Their Families. I first asked Alice Drager to walk us through what types of conditions fall under the umbrella of intersex.
There's a lot of different conditions, so some of them involve genetic anomalies in terms of sex chromosomes. So most of us are born with either XX or XY, but some people can be born with those combinations of those types, or they can be born with XXY or 1X and no second chromosome. We can also find conditions which involve when a child is born having sex anatomy that's unclear, so that would be in the genital region. And then there can also be various kinds of conditions where somebody appears to be one sex on the outside, but internally they have some of the organs of the other sex.
And at what point of life are DSDs typically diagnosed?
They're diagnosed across the lifespan. So in some cases, Even before birth, a fetus can be diagnosed as having a DSD, either through a sonogram or through a genetic screening test. It can also happen at birth. It can happen at teenagehood, at puberty. It can happen later in life when you are having problems with fertility and you go to a fertility specialist. And it even sometimes happens in 80-year-old people who die from old age and somebody discovers it in an autopsy.
How common are they?
How common it is depends on what you're going to count in the categories of standard male or standard female. Because when we're talking about intersex, we're talking about anybody who counts in between. So you have to decide what counts as standard male or standard female. And to do that, you have to decide, what are you going to count as standard in terms of genitals? What are you going to count as standard in terms of chromosomes? But if we put all the different kinds of anomalies together, it comes out to about 1 in 100 people have some kind of variation of the standard male or the standard female type.
Just to help us get a sense of how often DSDs occur, are there any other congenital conditions that are more widely known but less prevalent than DSDs?
Sure, lots of things, like Down syndrome is less common but more widely known. Various kinds of variations in nose types or ear types that may be relatively unusual, but you'll notice them. So, for example, being born with very large ears, people know about that, but it tends not to be that common in the population. The reason we're unaware that sex anomalies happen is because our society tends to be organized into a two-sex category, so everybody just kind of blends in. But once you start looking biologically, then you realize sex is actually really complicated, and humans vary a lot more than we've recognized until recently.
Arlene, I understand that you have two daughters who were diagnosed with androgen insensitivity syndrome. Briefly, what is that?
Androgen insensitivity syndrome, or AIS, is a condition in which children are born female and they happen to have XY chromosomes and testes. And during fetal development, their testes make male hormones or androgens, but their bodies are completely immune or insensitive to those male hormones, so they develop as female.
What was it like for you and your family to find out about this condition?
Well, at the time, I'm a physician, and I had been taught in medical school that intersex or DSD conditions were something just horrifying that patients could never know about. So if we were physicians and we were treating these patients, we'd have to do something to change them, and then it is imperative that they never find out about their condition or they might commit suicide. So for me as a young mom to find out about that was really devastating.
Were there places you could seek out help or advice about caring for your children?
I had really excellent medical care in Pittsburgh and physicians who were very progressive, but in terms of the kind of help that I really wanted, meeting other parents or meeting other people living with those conditions, it was not available.
How old are your children, and how has this evolved over their lives?
Over their lives, it's very interesting. When they were diagnosed, there was an older paradigm of treating children with the secrecy and not telling them about their condition. By the time they were in their mid-teens, I had found a support group which really advocated for telling the truth and being honest. So my family and I did that. And now they're both in their late 20s. My older daughter, Katie, is a physician herself, training in psychiatry, wants to be a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And actually, it's ended up being one of the best things in our lives because we've met all kinds of people, had interesting relationships. Katie and I have had a chance to be public advocates. It really hasn't hindered them in anything. They're happy and healthy in relationships. I couldn't be happier for them.
Our guests are Arlene Barretts, Pittsburgh radiologist and parent leader at the AIS-DSD support group. We're talking about intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Our other guest is Alice Drager, professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Alice, as you discussed earlier, types of DSDs vary, and so do, I imagine, options for parents and individuals about what to do with this condition. What are some of the various options?
It really depends on the condition we're talking about. So some of the conditions actually have medical problems that go along with them. AIS is not one of the ones that has an active medical problem, but women with AIS who have not had their testes removed have a slightly increased risk of testicular cancer. So they have to be monitored for that or have their testes taken out. There's one condition that makes intersex genitals in girls fairly common, and that's a condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH. And that's a condition where you have an endocrine defect. And the problem with that is, regardless of the intersex part of it, if the child doesn't get diagnosed with CAH, the child can go into a adrenal crisis and actually get quite sick or even die. So now in this country, we actually have screening in all 50 states for children to be all screened for CAH because it's a serious endocrine problem. So part of what we're talking about is some of these conditions have underlying medical issues, and those have to be dealt with. But when you get into the question of the optional medical issues, a lot of times some physicians, especially surgeons, advocate for trying to make everybody look sexually typical. And so they'll try to introduce the topic of genital surgery for children for what is essentially a cosmetic reason. And that's quite controversial.
And how common is that?
How common is surgeons recommending it?
Yeah, for that very reason you just explained.
Well, surgeons have as their chief tool surgery. So they tend to offer it and even to recommend it. But what we're trying to do, what people like Arlene are trying to do, is to push very hard to make sure that mental health is the group that leads in these situations. So that what we have is a much calmer approach that deals with the stress, deals with the confusion, deals with the anxiety, and really approaches it as something where we address familial resilience, so the strengths of the family, the ability of the family to bond and to love, and really try to go in that direction before any questions about unnecessary medical interventions come up.
What possible effects can these types of surgeries have on children?
They can be quite devastating. So in some cases, there's no problems that come from them. But in some cases, people are left with scarring from the surgery, with incontinence from the surgery, with loss of sexual sensation or sexual pain. And those are often addressed with additional surgeries and additional surgeries. So there's people I know who have had dozens of surgeries, all to try to correct the mistakes or the problems that came from the first surgery. So these are not without risk. And I think Arlene and I are on the same page in terms of really trying to support the idea that you should let children have their bodies intact, if at all possible, so that they can decide what to do with them, unless there's a dire medical emergency.
Arlene, tell us more there. Walk us through what this situation looks like from the parents' point of view. When a doctor believes surgery is required, are other options presented to parents?
They may be presented, but not in a way that makes them very appealing to parents. Often the choice is presented as surgery or nothing. And the other option to surgery is psychosocial support. As Alice mentioned, we're really interested in having behavioral health people support families. Having other families support them is very important. What parents really need is to be reassured that their child is beautiful and perfect, that they can love that child, and that their child is going to be happy and successful. If they're going to be thinking about surgery, they need to be presented honestly with the information about the kinds of complications that Alice mentioned. And they also need to know that sometimes this surgery is done on children in whom the surgery functions to reinforce a gender that is assigned to them. And sometimes those children don't feel inside like that gender when they get older, and parents are often not informed of that.
So sometimes it does result in a, quote, incorrect, unquote, gender assignment?
That's right. And there's nothing wrong with physicians and parents doing that at birth. You're taking a shot at predicting how that child will feel as an adult, and you don't always get it right. So there's nothing wrong with that, because that is something that can change. We have parents whose families have undergone a gender transition with their children, and it's been fine with support. What is a problem is when the wrong gender assignment is made and reinforced with irreversible surgery, and then you have a child who's had a catastrophic procedure, and that's not a good outcome.
How often is this psychosocial support offered?
That's a good question. There are centers in the country that are supposed to be centers of excellence. They are centers of excellence, and they offer psychosocial support to some extent. Realistically, how often it's easily available is another question. There are problems getting funding for psychologists, social workers, and other types of support people. And so realistically, parents don't always have access to those services. In terms of other kinds of support, like referring to a support group, some places are very good at doing that. other places not so good. So it really varies.
What we're really trying to focus very much on, Mark, and Arlene's been very active with the group Accord Alliance, who I've helped as well. Accord Alliance is the main group nationally trying to push for these centers for excellence to have psychosocial care. What we're really trying to get people to is the understanding that what we care about is health, not normality. And so what we really want to do is reach the point where these children's health is our center concern, and not whether or not they look exactly like every other boy or every other girl. And in that, we can try to play to the strengths of the families, because many families are actually healthy families with resiliency, and they can be helped to understand how it's possible to raise a child who's healthy and maybe a little atypical, but that's not that big a deal, that we're all different in some kind of way. This may be a more stressful one, but we can deal with that stress.
In your opinion, are physicians doing their due diligence to make sure that parents are fully informed of all the risks of associated with these procedures?
Some physicians are, but some of them, I think, feel that there really is no other way to care for a child other than to offer them normality. And the reason they're doing that is not because they're bad people, but because they're good people. They see themselves as having the best interests of the child in mind, and they're convinced that in order to have a successful life, you have to have a body that looks like other people's bodies. But what we try to do is encourage them to understand that the data is not there to support that point of view, that we know lots of people who grew up with sex atypicality, different kinds of sex types, who actually did well because their parents loved them, their parents were helped in terms of taking care of them, their parents were really focused on their overall well-being, not on whether or not they looked like everybody else. But a lot of surgeons, I think, feel that it's quick and easy from their point of view. It's not too often that something goes wrong, so why not go ahead and take a shot at it?
Alice Drager is our guest, professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. We are joined by Arlene Barretts, a parent leader at the AISDSD support group, about intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Arlene, what are some of the long-term effects of these surgeries on the family life of an intersex individual?
Well, as they affect the individual, they affect the family. So if a child has surgery that the child later on doesn't wish he or she has not had, there's a lot of unhappiness there, and children can blame their parents for putting them through that. They may not understand that their parents did it out of love, out of a desire to protect them, and that their physicians thought it was the best thing, but there can be a lot of anger, a lot of anger there. It also sometimes impairs those adults from having relationships when they have issues with their bodies, when they have issues with their sexual function. It's hard for them to have relationships, and that's very painful for parents to have raised a child and have that child not be able to be in a loving relationship. So definitely can affect families.
Through your work, Arlene, have you seen a difference in the family lives of parents who have chosen to delay or opt out of surgery as opposed to those who decide to operate?
I do. We have lots of families, actually, who are raising their children openly, just letting them have their difference and live with it, and they're doing very fine. They're very healthy. There are actually families who choose to adopt children with genital difference. There's a whole group of parents who've adopted children internationally and are raising them to be healthy people. I think that the tone is really set by the parents and the family, and if parents can get off on the right foot with their medical care and with psychosocial support, then they can feel confident and do a good job raising these children to be healthy adults.
Given all the various potential outcomes involved here, it would seem that there's a lot of potential for guilt on the part of the parents here. Arlene, can you tell us more about how this played out in your family?
In my family, I certainly did feel quite guilty, because I was the person who had transmitted this genetic condition to my daughters. When you have children, you know that it's two children, you know that it's in your family, in your own genes. I felt guilty about that. I felt very guilty and stressed that I would do something wrong that would prevent them from being happy later on. I wasn't sure how and when to give them information. That was very difficult. If I had had the support all along and just had people giving me ideas for parenting or reinforcing that things that I was doing were going to be okay, a lot of that could have been avoided.
And how has this played out in families who chose to pursue surgery?
Some of those families have joined our support group, and they do have regret about having made those decisions. And we know actually from some recent medical studies that about half of parents regret making a decision even to have the most simple of genital cosmetic surgeries. So it's not that surprising. They do have to accept that they made the best decision at the time with the information that was given to them. You know, lots of times they've been in these situations where they heard limited information before they consented to a procedure. And whether you've made a decision for surgery or not to have surgery, the most important thing is just to love your child and be open about things and let your child know that you'll always be there for them.
So in both of your opinions, these procedures are unethical when the child cannot participate in the decision, Alice?
I think it's fair to say that we don't allow parents to make whatever decision they want to make about children's bodies in other realms when a child is healthy. So, for example, say a parent wanted to come in and give a child an adult type of vaccine at an adult level of vaccination or an adult medication, we would say, no, you can't do that. That's not really something that this child needs. It's not something that we know to be safe and know to be effective. So I think this is one of those circumstances where what we can say now from what we know, we don't know it to be necessary. We know that it may be unnecessary. We know that there's a lot of issues with safety, and we know that it's not particularly effective based on the outcome systems in terms of telling us that these children are better off with surgery than without. What I would say is, in general, it shouldn't be offered. That in general, what should happen is the parents should be referred to these good teams, and what should happen is the mental health professional should lead and help parents deal with the anxiety and the stress and the confusion and the joy and the hope and the love that they're feeling, and really deal with that and deal with the issue that really is the issue, which is in many cases parental stress.
Arlene Barrett, anything to add to that?
I agree with Alice. Parents will often ask for this. They just think right off the bat that this can be fixed. I think they need to know that it can't be fixed, that they can't fix their own feelings, that they can't fix their children's bodies and make them be happy people by changing their bodies.
And what needs to change to make this decision or non-decision better for everyone involved, Alice?
I think the primary thing that needs to change is people need to change how they think about this. They need to stop thinking about abnormality meaning unhealth and start thinking very clearly about what health is as opposed to what something unusual is. And once we get there, then I think we'll have a system where we stop referring people to surgeons simply because somebody has a difference as opposed to somebody has something that's genuinely unhealthy. We'll start to sort out with these conditions, is there an underlying health concern? And some of them there are. And in that case, we deal with the underlying health concern. But we have to sort it out and figure out that the things that are not health concerns but are really social concerns should be dealt with socially by having the rest of us grow up now for the sake of the children.
Is there anything you'd care to add to that, Arlene?
I think society needs to change. I think that clinicians, physicians need to change their attitudes as well and understand that parents are capable of doing this. They don't always seem to be able to absorb that. I think they have to make it their business to get involved with support groups. The more clinicians are involved with us, the better information the support groups are able to give to the families who join them, and the more clinicians will understand what actually goes on in those support groups and that there are plenty of healthy families out there who are living with these conditions with minimal interventions.
I think Arlene makes a really good point, and that's that physicians often underestimate the ability of parents to grow. And one of the things that we see is that parents in these circumstances at the beginning often think they can't handle it. But that's true with a lot of things with parenting. And people do learn how to deal with things. I mean, I've met parents who, when their first child turned out to be a child with a DSD, that was a disaster because they'd never been a parent before. But when I meet parents whose 7th or 8th or 10th or in one case 12th child turned out to be the child with DSD, they said, oh, kids throw stuff at you and you learn to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And their attitude was, this is one of those things the world throws at you. And as a parent, you got to learn how to take everything and cope with it.
We want to thank our two guests for an interesting and important discussion. Alice Drager is professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Arlene Barrett joined us from Pittsburgh. She's a radiologist and a parent leader in the AISDSD support group. Our topic has been intersex conditions and how they affect those diagnosed and their families. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
With school just about to begin again, America's largest pediatricians group is saying, "Let sleeping kids lie," the American Academy of Pediatrics says in a new policy statement that middle school and high school shouldn't start before 8:30, later if possible. It points to an epidemic of delayed, insufficient, and erratic sleep patterns among teens. This is from USA Today's Michelle Healy, by the way. It describes 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep as optimal for teenagers. The National Sleep Foundation says 45% of teens get fewer than 8 hours a night. Current state on WKAR, say you're a woman and you're interviewing for a job in a traditionally male-dominated field like engineering. What qualities about yourself should you highlight in your interview? Well, a new MSU study offers some ideas, and our Melissa Benmark has more.
Well, I'm sure, as you can imagine, why would a female like me be interested in a study about women in mostly male-dominated fields like radio, right? So I talked to one of the study's co-authors, that's Anne-Marie Ryan, and she's a professor of organizational psychology here at MSU, and first kind of laid out what the study was looking at.
Well, we were particularly interested in the fact that there's a lot of conflicting advice for job applicants, particularly job applicants who maybe belong to a social category, a gender group, an ethnic group, an age group, where there might be concern about stereotyping, in particular in association with going for certain types of jobs. And so in this study, we looked at whether women who are applying for a job in a male-dominated field, how they might approach this issue of talking about that fact in an interview, should they talk about it at all, that they're a woman in a very male-dominated field, and then what attributes, when talking about themselves and their skills, should they perhaps emphasize to make sure that they're combating stereotypes that might exist, or at least making sure they get the job they deserve. So we looked at both the fact that if you acknowledge, I am a woman in a male-dominated field, is that okay, or is that seen as sort of playing the gender card? And then the other thing we looked at was how they described themselves and how that led to differences in evaluations. And what we found is that describing yourself in more what we would call agentic terms, which would be things like ambitious, assertive, that's seen as fitting the job. The job we used was a manager in an engineering firm, versus describing yourself in terms that are associated with good leadership, like being a supportive developmental leader, really supporting your employees, also seen as good leadership qualities, but traditionally associated with being more feminine. And we found that that actually resulted in lower evaluation. So really describing oneself or emphasizing the side of oneself, examples of when one is assertive or ambitious, takes charge, would be a good idea. Simply talking about acknowledging the fact that one is somewhat of a minority in a field was not really a positive thing to do.
So talking about the 800-pound gorilla is probably not the way to go.
Right. And it's interesting because there is conflicting advice about that. There are other studies that have shown, for example, if someone has a physical disability, it is a good idea to talk about it in the interview, even though you're not required by any means legally, just perhaps maybe to put the other person at ease. So this is one study. Hopefully we can do more research looking at how individuals manage their identity in interview situations, how they talk about themselves, particularly if they find that they may be in the minority or they may be stereotyped against, how best to manage that. I think it's important to emphasize, though, we are not saying that individuals are responsible for sort of preventing discrimination, or individuals should lie about who they are or what characteristics they possess in an interview. We're simply trying to say, as job seekers try to navigate the difficulties of finding a job, what advice is useful advice, what advice has no evidence to back it up.
It's interesting about that women going into male fields seem to do better when they emphasize male qualities. Do you know of any research that indicates that men going into traditionally female fields do better emphasizing female qualities?
Yeah, that would be an interesting question. I mean, we did look at men in our study, but for these particular jobs, and once again, did not find that men emphasizing what we would call more communal characteristics, being developmental, being nurturing, focusing on cooperation, that actually had negative effects. But that would be a logical next step for research.
To some extent, it makes sense that job seekers would try to say what they think will get the potential employer to hire them. But how is this different than that?
It does fit under, I guess, the broader umbrella of impression management in an interview. And everybody wants to put their best foot forward. Once again, impression management isn't necessarily lying about who you are or presenting a false profile. It's just, how can I make the best possible impression about my qualifications? This particular line of research focuses specifically on those kinds of aspects of impression management that deal with your social group identity. So, for example, if you're an older worker and you're going for a job, some of our research has looked at, well, older workers get advice about maybe, you know, lie about your age, dye your hair, you know, make sure you delete things from your resume that might make you seem dated. You know, older workers might be dealing with stereotypes, especially in an industry that's fast-paced, like a tech industry. If they're moving from an older industry, manufacturing industry, how can they show that, yes, I am innovative, I'm able to keep up? How do you emphasize that? How do you bring that out? So this is about managing or putting your best foot forward in an interview in relation to the stereotypes that might exist about a particular group you belong to.
When women played up their quote-unquote masculine traits, was there a difference in how they were perceived depending on whether the employer, the interviewer, was male or female?
Actually, we did not find much of a difference. We did look, though, at the level of sexism endorsed. And individuals who are sexist definitely have a bias, and that's apparent. And I think that's important to recognize, too. A lot of times we think, well, these are just biased people, biased interviewers. No, once you control for actually their level of biased attitudes and you still find effects, we're talking really about things that are a little less conscious for all of us about how we think about people and how we categorize them.
One of the masculine-like traits you mentioned is assertiveness, and isn't it potentially kind of a double-edged sword because some women are afraid they'll be perceived as strident or aggressive or rather than assertive in a positive way?
Oh, yes, definitely. And there is research that shows that women who are very assertive get more negative, for example, performance evaluations in the workplace. So this is this balancing act, this conflicting advice about how do I present myself and make sure they see me as fitting this job, and the job is seeing the job. There's a stereotype associated with the job that you have to be a take charge kind of go-getter, goal setter. How do I show that, but at the same time not be perceived as not fitting my gender role? So some of the research talks about this is a dilemma for people who are pursuing a job where the role is kind of incongruent with their gender group, or as I mentioned before, older workers seeking a job maybe in a field that's perceived as youthful, fast pace. The stereotype of the occupation isn't consistent with the stereotype of the group they belong to. And so they've got to think about, well, how do I be true to myself? What do I emphasize? Do I focus on, well, here's what I bring different to the table, the counter stereotype in relation to my social category? Or do I focus on how I fit the job, or what kinds of things should I do, or what should I think about? And we're really finding it's probably pretty complex. And so I think it's really important for people to be conscious, though, of the fact that as they go into job-seeking settings, that all of these forces are at play.
When you do research like this, I can imagine that either your peers or just colleagues or just civilians who are responding to a story they read on the MSU website, that this is maybe a lot more polarizing than finding a new virus or something like that, that people can take the tack that, you know, women are complaining about this or that men are being sexist about this or whatever. Do you get really passionate responses from people about your research?
That's a really good question, and I think sometimes it does. And I think part of it is people don't really read the research, so they're looking at kind of a short clip or a headline and saying, oh, women, man up. Oh, no, that's bad. And they haven't really, you know, that was the question posed in the research. And they're not really getting into, well, here's the different strategies that one might use and why this might be important to look at and why it's not just about women. It's about all of us. All of us come to workplace situations, to job interviews, we bring with us who we are. How we manage our identity in the workplace is really important, whether it be age, religion, gender, ethnicity, anything, sexual orientation, anything about your background, it's part of who you are. Now, we would all say, well, it's not really relevant to the job, it's not really relevant to getting a job, but we also know from years and years of research that we do unconsciously categorize people. It's the way we process information about them. And so if there are things that I as an individual can do coming to a workplace situation to help make things smoother for myself, I think I want to know that.
All right. Dr. Anne-Marie Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we welcome Peter Lark, the General Manager of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. Lots to talk about with Mr. Lark. Tree cutting standards, a rate hike, how dozens of reforms are unfolding at the Lansing Board of Water and Light. We also feature Peckham's Next Step program on our Neighbors in Action segment. That and more tomorrow on Current State. We're glad you could join us. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5. WKAR.